We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview. The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Well, happy Friday, and today is February 14th, so happy Valentine's Day to everyone out there. I love Valentine's Day. I know that it is just this like cheesy Hallmark-created holiday, but I am totally fine with that because there is more pink sparkle in the world. And when you go out and you just see all of the little hearts everywhere, it's just a happy, magical time. And I am also one of those people that loves conversation hearts. So yeah, you can feel free to, you know, throw up a little bit in your mouth right now and be like, Jenna, what are you doing? But happy Valentine's Day to all who choose to celebrate. And, let's get started though with more serious things. The AP had a statement on Oval Office access, and we're going to start there this morning. They said this: as a global news organization, the Associated Press informs billions of people around the world every day with factual, nonpartisan journalism. Today, we were informed by the White House that if AP did not align its editorial standards with President Donald Trump's executive order renaming the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America, AP would be barred from accessing an event in the Oval Office. This afternoon, AP's reporter was blocked from attending an executive order signing. It is alarming that the Trump administration would punish AP for its independent journalism, limiting our access to the Oval Office based on the content of AP speech. Not only severely impedes the public access to independent news, it plainly violates the First Amendment. So the FIRE org, which is an organization that defends and promotes free speech for all Americans in courtrooms, at least according to their website, posted this: punishing journalists for not adopting state-mandated terminology is an alarming attack on press freedom. That's viewpoint discrimination, and it's unconstitutional. President Trump has the authority to change how the U.S. government refers to the Gulf, but he cannot punish a news organization for using another term. The role of our free press is to hold those in power accountable, not to act as their mouthpiece. Any government efforts to erode this fundamental freedom deserve condemnation. So let's welcome in Aaron McIntyre, who is a producer and commentator at The Blaze. He also is the producer for our good friend Steve Dace's show. So, Aaron, what's your thought on this? Does the AP and FIRE have a point here?
Well, good morning, Jenna. And I told your producer the other day when he asked me if I want to come on to talk about this, I said, I really don't care about this. But the more I thought about it, I don't know, I think we could have an interesting conversation. So I have kind of two takes on this story, and there's one take, you know, there's one little take that I want to get your assessment on. But I kind of have two takes. One is kind of a granular and small and kind of focus on this particular story, and then one is the big picture. Kind of on the granular level, the small level, I kind of, you know, they booted them out of the White House Oval Office the other day because they're not referring to the Gulf of America as the Gulf of America. You know, they're not, I don't know, maybe they're limiting access elsewhere, you know, elsewhere as well. Maybe this is less of a First Amendment issue and more of an ethical issue. And that's what I'd want to get your take on just as an attorney. But, you know, in the short term, it's kind of a little kerfuffle from my vantage point. And so I'm not really sure if there's as much ado about nothing or whether there's something more there. But when you look at the big picture, the Associated Press, especially the AP style guide, but the Associated Press is largely the mouth of the river of controlling language in this country. If it's not the mouth of the river, it's the rapids by which the river accelerates its flow and current into the rest of the bloodstream of rhetorical debate in this country. And you know, as an attorney, that whoever controls the language controls the debate, and whoever controls the debate will win the debate. So when you see these terms like, let's just go back to homosexual marriage, there's no such thing as homosexual marriage. There's just marriage as defined by God, one man, one woman. There's no such thing as transgender women. There's just women. That's what it is. And I know I'm being explicit here, but we have to get down to brass tacks, because the left and their apparatchiks in the media, like the Associated Press, have so degraded our language to control our language that we have to be very clear with what we're talking about here. So the Associated Press, the notion that they won't even call the Gulf of America by its name, but they will acquiesce to every single piece of rock gut that comes out of academia, put that in the style guide, and then demand that everyone refer to these terms, these new made-up terms, by what they demand them to be. I just listed a couple of them for you. I think the irony of that is really, really rich. So I don't really have that much sympathy for the Associated Press. Now, I will say this, if you're an organization like FIRE, which does some really good work, and they are truly trying to play, they're really, truly trying to play a neutral arbiter here, and they are First Amendment, basically maximalists. I really appreciate the consistency. I mean, if you're an organization like that or an attorney looking at a case like this, you want to make sure that you are absolutely doing as neutral of a job as possible with which cases you pursue and which you drop, because you don't want a judge to deny you standing someday merely based solely on the fact, well, FIRE, you represented only right-wing cases and you never defended left-wing cases, you know, you're immediately discounted. So I understand why they're doing that. But my take on this is that the irony here is absolutely rich with the Associated Press. I think my only regret is that the White House didn't even go further. But that's maybe a story for another day. But I don't know. I see this more of maybe an ethical issue, because I'm not totally sure if the Associated Press has been denied complete access to the White House, to the rest of the government, or if it's just this one event that went down the other day.
Right. And I agree with you on at least the granular level, that even when this whole Gulf of America versus Gulf of Mexico thing first came up, I'm sitting here thinking, okay, that's not what I voted for. Like, who cares? And it doesn't really matter. But in the grand scheme of everything else that Trump 2.0 is accomplishing, I'm going like, all right, fine. If you want to rename that, have at it, because you're doing so much else that is so great. And it's actually hysterical to me to see the left's meltdown, because why wouldn't the AP just go along with this renaming? Because even Google Maps at this point has changed the name on Google Maps to be Gulf of America. So for them to use the term Gulf of Mexico purposefully, not going along with the executive order, I think is signaling an intentional disregard of the presidential authority. And so that's where you're right, that language matters. And that type of response is just obstinate, it's hostile, and it probably violates their own ethical journalistic standards, which is why I found this story fascinating. But then also on the level of Trump barring them access to this event, I don't know that it rises to the level of a First Amendment challenge, just from a legal ethical standpoint, to say, well, we're going to not allow you access to this one event when everything is live streamed. Like, in terms of just reporting on it, yeah, maybe they can't ask the president, the reporter can't ask the president a question, but how many other news outlets didn't have room to come in there? That's not a First Amendment violation to say every outlet under the planet can come in and have access there. So, you know, whether or not this is sort of a tit for tat kind of, you know, just turf war thing from now the White House and the AP, I think it raises, though, the overall question of journalistic integrity. Because if the AP, Aaron McIntyre, my special guest this morning from The Blaze, if the AP wants to be seen as a legitimate journalistic entity instead of an obstinate left-leaning, bias-driven, narrative-driven outlet, then why wouldn't they just call it Gulf of America? Like, who cares?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm glad to hear your perspective on that, because that was kind of my take as well. I wasn't sure that this really, you know, rose to the level of a First Amendment case. But yeah, the Associated Press, in the statement that you just read a few moments ago, the Associated Press said, we're nonpartisan, fact-based reporting. Well, your statement was awesome except for those three or four words there, that phrase. Everything else was fine except for the fact where you, or except for the part where you called your yourself nonpartisan and fact-based. I mean, you look, when I talk about the mouth of the river of controlling language in this country, Jenna, I live in Iowa. Okay, we're not a huge media market in Des Moines. I think we're like in the 70s as far as media markets go. But if I had a dollar for every time that I clicked on a story from one of our local TV news stations online because the headline is so outrageously dumb and leftist, and then I went and read the story and it was just the same, and then I go up and read the byline expecting to see what local journalist wrote this trash, the byline almost with ubiquity is the Associated Press. I don't know if you've seen this video. It's been floating around for years now. I think it emerged during the first Trump administration, but it is a series, dozens, I believe, of local TV news stations saying in unison, reading in unison, the exact same story. We love covering our stories here in backyard, fill in the blank, you know, TV markets, you know, wherever you want to pick in the United States. And then they, in unison, these dozens of TV news stations say, thus and such is a threat to our democracy. If you want to know why all of them just seemingly coincidentally stumbled upon the exact same words, the exact same messaging, I would wager it is the Associated Press. They are, their wire service is used by so many different news outlets around the country. Now, I think their influence is probably waning, but it is irony of the highest order that for a number of years, and I think this is still the case, if you are a right-wing news outlet and you do not adhere, at the very least in your headlines for different stories or articles or posts, if you do not adhere to the AP style guide for how you use the English language, you will get dinged in your search optimization, meaning that Google will automatically degrade how many people can see your stories if you don't obey the way the Associated Press wants you to write and wants your readers and listeners to read and listen. So it is the height of irony. It's the absolute height of irony that for years now, right-wing outlets have had to kowtow or find creative ways to get around the AP style guide. No, I'm not going to call a man a woman. I'm not going to call a woman a man. No, I'm not going to refer to homosexual marriage as anything other than an abomination. What have you? Those are just the two examples, the most egregious examples that came to the top of my mind. It is the height of irony that for years now we've had to kowtow to their language, and now they won't make a little change like Gulf of America, and now they're crying that they were left out of one event because of that. It is just ironic. By the way, maybe I'm being too hard on the Associated Press, because I will say I was kind of like you. I don't really care about renaming the Gulf of Mexico. I do prefer the American Gulf instead of Gulf of Mexico. Maybe that's what they're upset about. If so, then I'm probably being too hard on them.
Well, yeah, and I think that the points that you raise, Aaron McIntyre, are really good in terms of the overall legacy media's gatekeeping of journalism. And they're wanting to say that, you know, we should have free and fair access to all of these stories, and yet they're not even allowing others that use their own stories to have that same kind of free and fair just opinion, even if it's an opinion piece, much less a reporting piece. And so there's a lot of hypocrisy, shocker, going on with the left. And that raises the broader question, I think, about how much the Trump administration is really, I think, smartly engaging the culture war and just pushing back against all of these legacy gatekeepers with the announcement from the very first White House press briefing that, you know, podcasters and non-traditional media outlets will be granted press passes. That was something that, of course, then the legacy media kind of had a meltdown over. And this is trying to open the floodgates of alternative media to say that more speech is better. And that is a First Amendment principle, to say it shouldn't just be a couple of elitists in their ivory towers from the Pentagon, right, and their little offices. It should be that we have more speech so that the average reader can hear what's going on from a wide variety of sources. And it's not just the tailored bias that we've become accustomed to with what's rightly termed the fourth estate of the media. So how do you think all of this in a much broader sense is potentially going to shift the cultural narrative moving forward into the next 4 years?
Well, Jenna, let's take a step back real quick. Tell Jenna Ellis and tell Aaron McIntyre a year ago on February 14th that we would both agree with the statement, Donald Trump is smartly engaging the culture war as he begins his second term in office. I think being that both of us, I think we were on the same side in the primary, and this
right.
was, you know, basically after the primary was already over. I mean, to say that... It's incredible, and it's just a testament to the job that they have done, because I've never been more happy to be more wrong about this guy, and so far he keeps proving me wrong. But to get to your point about
well said.
engaging alternative media and really broadening free speech, I just want to go back to the last three elections just to kind of underscore the point that you're making. In 2016, Donald Trump formulated and he brought to bear an alternative ecosystem in the digital sphere, very much like Barack Obama had done and pioneered during his tenure in office. Donald Trump effectively leveraged digital media, and the left didn't know what to do with it. They were caught off guard. They were unprepared. And who won in 2016? Donald Trump. Go to 2020. COVID. All of the censorship that went down online coming out of COVID. You look at Hunter Biden's laptop from hell that was just overtly squashed and censored over and over and over again. The censorship machine was in full gear, leveraged against Donald Trump, who won that election, allegedly, Joe Biden. 2024, there's one major digital platform, social media platform, that's owned by someone who believes truly, excuse me, in free speech, and that's X or Twitter. Donald Trump was able to leverage digital media once again, effectively, without the fear of censorship. Those are three case studies to underscore your point. More speech is better. When we truly have a free speech system, truly, when people don't have their thumbs on the scales, i.e. Missouri v. Biden, when people don't have their thumbs on the scales, we can truly have at least some form of a real debate. Is it as high-minded worldview battle royale every single day that I think you and I would like it to be? No, but at least we're having a debate without fear of getting censored, at least in many, many cases. So I think those three elections are just, I think, good examples of what you're just talking about there, Jenna, is that we're trying to develop new and alternative sources for media. And there might very well be, in the near-term future, we might reach kind of a tipping point where there are so many new voices, so many new platforms, so many ways of disseminating messages that, yes, discernment, especially for believers in Jesus, discernment is going to be key, but also with the new media and the new voices and the new platforms, censorship is going to be a much harder task for those who would like to engage in it.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right, Aaron McIntyre, that discernment is going to be the key. I mean, it always has been, even when our sources were limited. We always had to read, being mindful of the bylines of the publications, all of that. But especially now with the oversaturation of so many voices and, frankly, so much noise that can come from social media and other alternative media, we do need to choose wisely and carefully who we listen to. to and in what context and for what purpose. I'm loving how Elon is just, you know, kind of doing the whole smash and grab of the of the legacy media. But that doesn't mean I'm going to go to him for, you know, my theological discourse, for example. So, you know, we have to be very mindful. We can read some of the other leftist media just to see what arguments the left is making so that we have informed responses. Because obviously, as 1 Peter 3 tells us, you know, always be prepared to give an answer for the hope that lies within you. We need to be able to speak truth back to those who are not being truthful. But discernment absolutely is the key. So, you know, this started as kind of that meh, Gulf of America, what does it matter conversation. But I think this was actually very worthwhile, Aaron McIntyre. So I appreciate you joining even, you know, against your better judgment there. So I appreciate it so much. And you can follow Aaron McIntyre and also listen to his excellent commentary on the Steve Dace show on The Blaze. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight, fight, fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight, fight, fight for the babies.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back. And one of the more interesting pieces of news that came out this week that I definitely wanted to get commentary on that, interestingly, the legacy media has not picked up at all, is that there is now a task force in Congress that is looking and reviewing at all of the files that are set to be released to the public by Donald Trump. This includes, of course, the JFK assassination files, among some other interesting things. And so Representative Anna Paulina Luna, who is actually representative here from my home state of Florida, said that she is leading that task force and has been posting on X, claiming that in her initial review, she now believes that there were at least 2 shooters in the JFK assassination, but hasn't given really any more detail than that. There's actually been a lot of commentary to her when she also posted a poll on X that was asking members of the public, do you believe that there was a second shooter? And a lot of people were saying, well, you know, why don't you just release the files and then we wouldn't have to guess or speculate? What's the purpose of a poll when you're supposed to just be releasing this information? And she's responded basically saying that they're going to do, the task force are going to do kind of this initial review and then release all of this to the public. But it's kind of an interesting way, I think, of going about this. So let's welcome in Scott Uhlinger, who is a former Naval Intelligence Officer. And Scott, what do you make of all of this?
Well, of course, it's very interesting stuff, because one thing I've always been interested in is the Kennedy assassination, and I've done a fair amount of reading on it in the past, let's say, 10 years. And so I'm interested by her comments, because there are other people who have said that the papers that will be released are relatively underwhelming. In other words, we may be expecting a big payoff and we may not get it. Now, hopefully that is not the case, and what she's saying is true, but certainly there are a lot of irregularities that would indicate a second shooter.
You know, and all of this, I think, Scott, is really fascinating because there has been speculation for a long time about a second or even third shooter, and also whether this was an inside job from the CIA, and the hit was directed by LBJ, and then this is kind of initially started, you know, the rise of the administrative state and some of these other things that previous to now, I think, have all just been kind of cabined as theories, maybe even conspiracy theories. But do you think that with President Trump saying that he's going to release these files, are we actually going to get to the truth of the matter?
I hope that we do. And I think that another thing that's interesting is that is that I think I'm like a lot of listeners, is that I was very interested in the Kennedy assassination and always followed it and all. But basically, in the last 5 years, we have been faced with living conspiracy theories, things that are happening in real time. And so the Kennedy thing has sort of faded in the background as we all begin to accept that there are conspiracies directed against the American people. And Trump's administration in the last 3 weeks has shown that this is absolutely the case. So I think Americans are ready, should the revelations be that there was a government conspiracy. I think Americans at this point are expecting it. And so I don't think it's going to be – it will be interesting, but it's not going to be earth-shattering the way it may have been 10 years ago, because I think we're so accustomed to the idea that now our government very much works against us, as Elon Musk is revealing through Doge.
That's a really excellent point, Scott Uhlinger, who's a former naval intelligence officer, that you know, if it came to light now that, you know, the government actually was responsible for this, I think a lot of people would just be like, well, that makes sense. You know, it wouldn't be, as you say, as monumentally earth-shattering, and would just further evidence why trust and faith needs to be restored in the government. But that also raises kind of the possibility that if it's not as conspiracy confirming, perhaps, as some people have believed since the assassination and the event itself took place, do you think that some people just won't believe what the task force is revealing?
I think that that is also true. We can see that again in real time, what's happening now. There are a lot of people who are simply in denial, who don't want to accept the fact that for the last 30 years, the American people have been, you know, ripped off, and that, you know, monies that our hardworking taxpayers are earning are being foisted off to people like Black Lives Matter. There's always going to be some people who do not want to accept the obvious. And I think that that's what we will see. It's interesting. So as a CIA officer, I was always interested in, like, the Lee Harvey Oswald and his origins, so to speak. And reading about his career in the military, et cetera, it really always – it seemed to me, after reading a lot of evidence, that he was, in fact, some sort of CIA asset who was reassigned and given the job of being a pro-Castro type, when, in fact, he had actually started as an anti-communist. So that really that really felt to me like that was a CIA – that he had worked for the CIA benevolently, trying to do a good thing – when he went to Russia, for example, and that he was retooled to do something against Kennedy. And maybe he may have been actually unaware himself that he was a tool in a larger conspiracy.
That's really interesting. And, you know, it's sad that we're only getting to the truth of this potentially, you know, this many decades later. You know, has there been any real reason that you're aware of, or maybe, you know, this is another theory or whatever, why presidents prior to now, or even in Trump's first administration, he didn't declassify this?
I guess, of course, there's always the fact that you want to protect living people, or in this case, maybe families of people who are now deceased, but you don't want to hurt their, quote, good name, unquote. So maybe there's some of that. If there are some, let's say, prominent families who are featured in this conspiracy. But I think that the main reason it may have been kept undercover is for the reason we're seeing right now with Doge, that this was the time period in '63 where basically where the deep state, which, remember, 4 years ago, if you talked about the deep state, you were kind of a paranoid or a conspiracy theorist. Now it's widely acknowledged that there is a deep state. But that was when the deep state really got a hold of the United States and the bureaucracy began to take over. And so I think even Republicans who may have wanted to reduce the size of government and saw some of this going on, realized that releasing the Kennedy files would have been a bridge too far, that it would have been earth-shattering maybe to a lot of Americans, that their government was not working on their behalf. But now, especially after the COVID period, a lot of Americans have accepted that there is a great deal wrong with our government and it's working against the people. So now, in a lot of ways, you know, the release of this now is appropriate. It'll certainly be more accepted, I think, now than it may have been before, because the implications before were simply too much for most Americans to grasp. And I think that's changed now.
And perhaps, too, that the implications of this will be something that the current administration is actively already addressing, not that the American people would say, wow, this happened, and what is the current administration doing to actually modify government in a way that it's not working against American interests. And so that brings us to two of maybe the more controversial nominees for cabinet positions for Trump, and, you know, controversial, of course, depending on who you talk to. For the deep state and the administrative state, yeah, they're controversial, but for average Americans like us who want to see our government working on our own behalf, I think we're big fans. And of course, I'm speaking of Tulsi Gabbard, who was just recently confirmed for Director of National Intelligence, and then Kash Patel, whose confirmation will come up soon for FBI Director. I think these are two key positions with two individuals that can overhaul a lot of the intelligence and the community that certainly needs some overhauling. And let's also not forget John Radcliffe, who's now head of CIA. He was the DNI previously under Trump. I'm a big fan of John Radcliffe. How do you see some of these reforms potentially?
Well, there needs to be a huge amount of reforms. I mean, you could make a very convincing argument that the FBI should be abolished based on the incredible ways that it has violated the trust of the American people and actively worked against them. I'm maybe kind of sitting on the fence with that, but it certainly is possible you could disestablish the FBI and place, which does not mean you send everybody home, but it means that perhaps some people are sent home, but then others are reassigned to, let's say, the Marshals Service or other services. The law enforcement people would be transferred to other branches of law enforcement, and they just would no longer be in the FBI. That's possible, although I don't know if that's on the table. However, the DNI subject, I do think that, you know, she's a good candidate. I always think it's important to have an outsider do this, especially because DNI, remember, is something that's only existed for about 25 years, slightly less, and it is basically a bloated bureaucracy. It contributes almost nothing to the collection of intelligence. It's merely, as I like to say, it's a bunch of cud chewers who chew the cud, which is the type of stuff that I, as an operations officer in CIA, I collected it. And so now, instead of having three layers of management basically looking at and interpreting and analyzing the intelligence that I collected in raw form, now you've added three more layers of bureaucracy. So really, it hasn't contributed very much to U.S. national security. And I think it goes down as it was a mistake to do this. So the question is, what is Tulsi Gabbard going to be really streamlining the DNI, or is she going to actually be taking it apart? I don't think she is going to be taking it apart, but it's clear that you need to cut out about literally 50% of the DNI would need to be cut, because it is really contributing almost nothing to U.S. security.
Yeah, and that you make such a great point, Scott Uhlinger, that, you know, a lot of these big bloated agencies are only, you know, 10, 25, maybe 30 years in the making. And these aren't constitutionally created agencies or departments. These are things that were created by the deep state, the administrative state, and so should be at the very minimum, pared back, and they should be doing the actual function of working for the American people. And some of them, like the Department of Ed, for example, can just be completely abolished. Some of these other agencies that are totally unconstitutional should be abolished. But this is where the administrative bureaucracy is definitely going to dig in its heels. And we're already seeing that in a lot of the lawsuits that have been filed, and basically trying to say, oh no, executive branch, head of the executive, chief executive officer, Donald Trump, you know, the elected sitting president, you can't actually tell your own agencies how they should function and pare this back. I mean, that to me, from a constitutional standpoint, is utterly ridiculous. And there doesn't seem to be any sort of legitimate argument there.
No, and I think that we all need to have faith that, believe me, if you don't think that Trump has anticipated this development of obstructionist courts, that's crazy. He clearly has anticipated it, and he has a strategy to deal with it. So I think that eventually, you know, this will be brought before the Supreme Court, and they will rule, of course, in favor of the executive branch. So I think that that's something that's going to happen, and I think Trump wanted it to happen sooner rather than later because he plans on doing this much more in the future. Interestingly, the FBI, for example, they're very proud of this. In fact, you can go to the FBI website and see this, was created by an executive order in, like, let's say, I don't know, 1916 or 1919 or something. So in other words, it was created by an executive order and was never, and apparently it was never codified into like a law passed by Congress. So that means that literally, should he have the will, President Trump could abolish the FBI because it was created by an executive order and it can die with an executive order.
Yeah, and that's where the administrative state is seeing, oh, we created this, you know, outside really the bounds of you know, congressional purview, and we've done a lot of this just with the stroke of a pen or with USAID, for example, just which was created by executive order in I think it was 1961, and that can be undone, and all of those funds can be revisited, and so they're seeing in real time how creating this kind of extra constitutionally and certainly extra legally can be rolled back very, very quickly. And it's amazing to me, Scott, that President Trump is the first one, and in his second term, not even his first term, he's the first one that's actually being willing to take this head on and use the executive orders to remove prior executive orders and actually accomplish this. Why haven't other previous Republican presidents, or even Trump in his first term, taken this kind of bold initiative?
I think that the first Trump administration, he lacked the trusted circle around him who were willing, who had the will to do this, who basically saw this as a real problem and were determined to get to the bottom of it. I think, for instance, and in previous Republican presidents, I don't have much respect for, and they basically were part of this uniparty system, and so they had no incentive to do it. Reagan had an incentive to do it, but of course, it was not quite as deep as it is now, because that's like 45 years ago. But he just didn't have the, I guess, the will to really, he talked about abolishing Department of Education and never did it. So he had other priorities and he did not set time aside to do that. So thank God we have a president like we have now who's willing to do this and make these hard decisions, because what we've learned is that these decisions are not difficult to make, but they can be made and you can follow through with them, but you have to have the will to do it. And we did not have that will before. And now the American people are clearly tired of this and the American people are fully in support of this. So it's going to continue happening. And that's why, you know, I see a headline that in Washington, D.C., web searches for criminal defense attorneys are reaching all-time highs. And that's happening for a reason.
That's really fascinating as well. And yeah, I think Pam Bondi has put a lot of individuals on notice. And I hope that with further investigations and even some of these potential investigations now by states looking into, for example, Anthony Fauci, who, yes, he was pardoned on the federal level by former President Biden, but that doesn't mean that he can circumvent potential accountability on the state level. And, you know, and this is not just, oh, hey, you know, this is retribution. And so now the Trump administration and red states are weaponizing government because it was weaponized against Trump and his allies. This is just saying, you know, hey, we're actually going to use the power of government to enforce the law and hold people accountable who actually violated it, not just target political opponents. Because I think that Pam Bondi would go after a red state if they weren't enforcing immigration law in the same way that blue states are. I mean, I don't think that delineation or distinction matters to her or to the Trump administration. And so it's very fascinating as well how kind of the board is being reset, where it's not just about blue or red, Republican or Democrat. It's all about, are you actually America first, Constitution first, or do you have a special interest at heart? And that's actually putting a lot of, I think, deep state Republicans on notice in Washington as well.
That's right, because people are absolutely disgusted with them, such as Mitch McConnell, who voted, you know, was the one Republican against Tulsi Gabbard. I mean, Americans are sick of the corruption, and so it comes down to, are you corrupt or are you a just person? And it doesn't matter what party they're in. If they manage to wrap up a couple of Republicans in this corruption, then the American people and myself are more than happy to support that, because these people, these parasites, need to be destroyed, and I don't care what side they are on.
Yeah, absolutely. So well said. And Scott Uhlinger, always appreciate your time and your expertise on this. And I just really hope that we get to the bottom of, you know, a lot of this deep state corruption. We root it out in the administrative state, and we actually move forward with a government that is leaner, meaner, and actually working on behalf of the American people. So thanks very much. And we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back. And, you know, when we're talking about all of these different challenges to the legacy media being gatekeepers, to the government not actually working on behalf of the American people, and, you know, all of the different ways that the administrative state has used and abused taxpayer money and the good that Trump 2.0 is doing, the left, as Scott Uhlinger and other guests on my show this week have mentioned, the left is now screaming constitutional crisis, because, yeah, that's what they love to go to whenever something isn't going their way. They will trot out their little, you know, signs and billboards of language that they have excised from the Constitution and completely build their own theories around it. They don't even know what it says or what it means. They just want to appeal to the Constitution as the highest law of the land, which is an implicit acknowledgement that they know that when they're not getting their way. But what they think that the Constitution is there for is just to have the outcomes that they prefer rather than limit the power of government. And that's the problem with activist judges. And Caroline Leavitt, who is the White House press secretary, doing a phenomenal job, by the way, absolutely slammed activist judges this week from the briefing room who are attempting to thwart Trump, saying that they are abusing their power. Listen to this.
Now, before I take questions, I would like to address an extremely dishonest narrative that we've seen emerging over the past few days. Many outlets in this room have been fear-mongering the American people into believing there is a constitutional crisis taking place here at the White House. I've been hearing those words a lot lately. But in fact, the real constitutional crisis is taking place within our judicial branch, where district court judges in liberal districts across the country are abusing their power to unilaterally block President Trump's basic executive authority. We believe these judges are acting as judicial activists rather than honest arbiters of the law. And they have issued at least 12 injunctions against this administration in the past 14 days, often without citing any evidence or grounds for their lawsuits. This is part of a larger concerted effort by Democrat activists and nothing more than the continuation of the weaponization of justice against President Trump. Quick newsflash to these liberal judges who are supporting their obstructionist efforts. 77 million Americans voted to elect this president. And each injunction is an abuse of the rule of law and an attempt to thwart the will of the people. As the president clearly stated in the Oval Office yesterday, we will comply with the law in the courts, but we will also continue to seek every legal remedy to ultimately overturn these radical injunctions and ensure President Trump's policies can be enacted.
And I think she's absolutely right about this, that this is just an attempt to thwart President Trump from doing what the people elected him to do. And, you know, obviously, if it was the will of the people that the executive violated the U.S. Constitution in some way, shape or form, then it would be the role of the judiciary to say, well, no, sorry, you're limited and confined to the power that Article 2 actually provides. So that's why we aren't a direct democracy. We are a constitutional republic. We are a nation of laws and rules, not a nation of rulers, whether that is someone in the Oval Office or it's the sheer will of the people and the democracy. And so we aren't mob led. We have aspects of democracy embedded in our constitutional republic, but we have a highest law of the land. And this is what conservatives genuinely are attempting to conserve. The following by everyone, whether you're Democrat, Republican, something in between, or totally different, everyone has to abide by the same rules. And those rules do not shift and change depending on whether a judge prefers the policy that the elected is implementing. And so this is why we have two political branches, the legislative and the executive, and then we have one judicial branch. And they are collaborative, they are co-equal, and they are coordinate branches because they're not co-equal in terms of their authority. The legislative only has legislative authority. The judiciary only has judicial. So they're not equal in that sense. They are coordinate in the sense that they have the same authority source of the U.S. Constitution, but they have different and distinct limited authority that serve as a check and balance on each other so that we don't have the law making, the law enforcement, and the law review vested in the same individual. That is what our founders expressly rejected when they looked at where they had come from in England. And when they said, you know, we don't want kings. We don't want someone who has absolute power in and of himself. We want to make sure that a government is run of the people, by the people, and yes, for the people. And so this whole idea of a nationwide injunction that is thwarting President Trump from exercising legitimate authority of the executive really needs to be revisited, I think, by Congress. And this whole idea of reform and arguments for reforming nationwide injunctions are particularly apt right now as we're seeing what's happening in the judicial branch. So it really comes down to a couple of things, and it's a separation of powers issue as well, because when we're talking about the different coordinate branches and the separation of those limited powers, we see that the executive or the law enforcement or the policy prerogative of the executive is not in the judiciary. And so the Constitution vests only judicial power in the federal courts, but it limits it to actual cases and controversies. And so this is why one federal judge earlier this week, I think it was yesterday, rightly said that unions don't have standing to challenge Trump's federal payoffs for resignations. If that's a policy that he wants to implement among federal employees in these departmental agencies, he can. Now, whether he should, that's a political question for, you know, the pundits, for those of us, you know, here on radio. We can debate this on social media as a political question, but that is not within the jurisdiction of the judicial branch to arbitrate. And so the separation of powers requires that judges do not exercise their political will. They don't have any input on policy. Now, every human being, and that obviously includes judges here in America, will have a policy opinions. But necessarily accepting the robe of a judicial officer means that you set aside your policy opinions and you confine yourself, and this is what is called judicial restraint. You confine yourself to the actual role of Article 3. So that's what's called judicial modesty and limited jurisdiction. So we need to get back to these principles, and if we want to ensure that there are limited powers in the legislative and the executive, the two political branches, we also need to limit the power under Article 3 that already limits it, but we need to forcibly compel the limitation of the jurisdiction of the judicial branch. This is all about judicial reform. We've got to have that conversation in the United States. That's why Representative Eli Crane has actually called for the impeachment of some of these judges. I'm all for it. But you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Have a great weekend.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.